Welcome to the Tiger Performance Podcast, where we feature high-achieving entrepreneurs and coaches and share their performance journeys. Now, let's get started with the show.
Steve Adams here, founder and CEO of Tiger Performance and Medical Institute. I'm the host of the Tiger Performance Podcast, where I speak with entrepreneurs, executives, professionals, and thought leaders about their unique stories and performance journeys. We've had genetics experts, Super Bowl athletes, game-changing health professionals, and amazing entrepreneurs with stories that will inspire you. Okay, it's time to acknowledge the sponsor for today's episode, and that is the Tiger Medical and Performance Institute. Our focus is on the mid-career high achiever who, at a time they should be at their best, are starting to wear down from the pressure, stress, and sleepless nights. Tiger's unique system helps successful leaders complete a transformative medical makeover without the time-consuming and confusing fads or biohacks using our proven and proprietary system. The Tiger system is a personalized root cause approach to restorative medicine. Through the integration of doctor care and health coaching, we help successful people regain mental and physical energy and reach a peak state of health today, while enabling them to sustain elite performance and health tomorrow, expanding their impact, extending their careers. The Tiger system that is transforming lives today and creating better tomorrows can be yours. So what are you waiting for? Visit tigerpi.com today to learn more. All right, I'm really excited today. I have a very special guest. His name is Dr. Jeffrey Rediger. He's a MD. He also has a master's in divinity. He's a physician, best-selling author, and popular speaker. He's an assistant professor at Harvard Medical School and the medical director of McLean Southeast Adult Psychiatry and Community Affairs at McLean Hospital. A licensed physician and board-certified psychiatrist, he's also has a Master of Divinity degree from Princeton Theological Seminary. His research with remarkable individuals who have recovered from incurable illnesses has been featured on the Oprah Winfrey and Dr. Oz shows, among others. He's been nominated for the National BraveWell Leadership Award and has received numerous awards related to leadership and patient care. His best-selling book, Cured, Strengthen Your Immune System, Heal Your Life, is available at Amazon, local bookshops, and in multiple languages. Dr. Rediger, I'm so happy to have you on the Tiger Performance Podcast.
It's a privilege to be here. Thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. And we had a really good exchange before you came on today. And so I just know that our audience is going to be blessed by this. And I want you to know we're going to promote this heavily once it's recorded and sent out to you. So because I want people to hear the message, whether they ever work with Tiger Medical or you is really beside the point today. We want to try to impact as many people as possible. Right?
That's awesome. I'm very excited to speak with you.
Yeah. So, you know, just start, this is off script. Just tell me a little bit about your family.
So I come from a very conservative family. I was born in Indiana on a farm. My father has an Amish background. And although the details are difficult to discern completely, his father was a blacksmith in the Amish tradition. Uh-huh. And my mother was raised on ranches out in Montana.
Oh, wow.
And they met a number of years ago. And then I don't know all the details about how or when they left the Amish tradition. We moved out of the Amish community when I was 2 years old. I just found out recently that my parents met. My dad was talking marriage within 2 weeks, and they were married within 3 months.
So, lecture our kids for doing this kind of stuff, right?
Right. Worked out well for them.
Yeah.
And so dad grew up, he says, plowing with horses. I've never been able to figure out if he was Old Order Amish or Mennonite. He says he was Old Order Amish, but there's some gray lines in there that I don't know where those lines were for him exactly. Uh-huh. But the truth is, I grew up in a very conservative home, but going to public school during the day, and those two worldviews didn't mix very easily.
Right.
And so at home, the Bible was thought to be sufficient for all knowledge. At school, I was studying science, and there was concern about the evolution I was studying in school. And so there was, it was difficult. But starting at a young age, I began to try to reconcile really different worldviews. And that's what I continued to do when I left for college at Wheaton College in Chicago. And then still struggling with how you put these worlds together.
Yeah.
And going to seminary at Princeton and trying to go very deep into philosophy of science and theology and trying to understand how you bring different disciplines into dialogue and reciprocity with each other. I mean, we all live with an integration naturally of mind, body, and spirit, but how to bring them together in a way that intellectually makes sense. It's complicated because one of the brilliant aspects of Western culture is that we're really good at going deep into each particular discipline. The joke at Harvard is that the disciplines are connected only by the common heating plant that goes between them, but mostly don't have much interaction with each other. Historically, that's beginning to change. But historically, it's been a real issue where you have these disciplinary ghettos, really, almost.
Or silos, right?
Silos, yeah. Exactly. Yeah. So, I think one of the brilliant aspects of Western culture is that if you have a medical problem, you go see the physician or naturopath. Yep. If you have a psychological problem, you go see a psychotherapist. If you have a spiritual problem, you go see a rabbi, priest, minister, or a mom. But I think the people that I study, these people with remarkable recovery from incurable illnesses, what they did was they brought all these aspects of our being together in ways that took their lives to a different level. And I think when we don't step back from outside of the discipline we are trained in and look at all these other aspects of being human, we miss the opportunity to understand how our minds and our bodies and our spirits are so interrelated and what it takes to galvanize change at a completely different and meaningful level.
Doctor, do you want me to call you Dr. Rediger or just Jeff, or what do you want to
Either.
Say?
Okay. Both is fine.
I just love to respect people for the accomplishment. So I'll just say Dr. Rediger.
Whichever you want to find with me.
You know, when I got into my, so I grew up in a family that wasn't educated. I'm the first college graduate and got my MBA. And when I got into my late 20s, early 30s, I was a person of faith, but I didn't understand why I believed what I did. And so I went on a journey for 10 years with that. And, but also at the same time, I became a real follower of Warren Buffett and Charlie Munger, you know, from Berkshire Hathaway. And the thing I learned, especially from Charles Munger, was to integrate always. And so he encourages people to read in biology and engineering and philosophy and psychology. Because when you do that, it enables you to be a higher level thinker.
Yeah.
And you're talking about that. And so I did that, and it really did help me become much more effective and ultimately become an entrepreneur and be very successful at that because I was able to integrate. So as I was raising my kids, I struggled with the same thing. You know, how do I live in a conservative worldview on Sunday and at home and then out in the world? How do I integrate those? Because I want to be friends with people and be able to talk to them intelligently. And so we taught our kids that, you know, you don't have to be afraid of science or the Bible. You can integrate both.
Yeah. You've been on a similar journey as I have been. It sounds like I learned it in college that all truth is God's truth, for example. And that was very liberating for me. The Amish way is to leave.
Leave the world.
To leave culture, to leave the world, and to be very suspicious about the world. And that's very much the worldview I was raised in. So to begin realizing that there's truth in all the different aspects of culture and the different disciplines was a big transformation for me.
I'm sure. So talk about your clinical training and what you do now at Harvard and at McLean Hospital. Yes.
Yeah. Right. So seminary was a fabulous experience for me, and that helped me begin realizing that science is a great gift to the world, not just a tool of the devil with evolution.
Yeah, right.
So then, and I went home to Indiana one weekend while I was in seminary, and my best friends from high school, his mother said, "What are you going to do with all that education?" I said, "Well, I'm going to be a college professor." And she said, "You're going to get all that education and not do something to help people?"
Oh, wow. So I nailed you.
So it's again, the world views were so different from the world I was living in. So eventually what happened is, long story short, is I said, "Well, maybe I'll just go to med school." And people understood that. The world I came from understood that. I understood that at some level, the need to both do something practical with people I cared about, but also privately, I could still have my ideas and do the research I cared about. So med school turned out to be a perfect solution for all kinds of reasons. And so that's what I did. I went to med school and then did residency in psychiatry here at Harvard, and then was asked to join the faculty afterwards. And I've been medical director here at a branch of McLean Hospital and on the faculty since then.
So I used to live in Northern Virginia. It's not that McLean, Virginia, right?
No. McLean Hospital is the oldest psychiatric hospital in the country. It's been around for a long time. It's always ranked one or two in the country in terms of its quality and that sort of thing.
And you're in Boston.
Yes.
Yeah, correct. Yeah.
Okay. It does more NIH-funded research on the brain and neurobiology of the brain than any freestanding psychiatric hospital in the world, I believe.
Wow, that's fantastic. How much, just real quick, more of curiosity, and also for my audience, so they really get to know you, Dr. Rediger. Yeah. How much time are you allocating between your psychiatric practice and also, you know, teaching at Harvard?
So my position is a joint appointment to both McLean Hospital and to Harvard Medical School. Okay. And so I have a complex schedule around those commitments. So I spend a fair amount of my time in administrative and teaching and clinical work. I was also the chief at a major urban medical center for 14 years. Mm-hmm. And so I gave that up over a year ago in connection with Cured and the need to be responsible to that mission.
Yep.
So I've been in the medical and the psychiatric worlds and the academic world for quite a while now, for 20 years.
Sounds like you have a peak performer type schedule, and hopefully you're learning how to manage stress well too.
Yes. Studying the people I study has been really important for me in reforming my own life. That's for sure.
I'm sure. So let's launch into that. Before I go to the next question, just kind of paint the picture for our audience about what Cured is and what your mission is.
Okay. So in 2002, shortly after graduating from residency, an oncology nurse at Mass General came to me and said that she had just been diagnosed with pancreatic cancer, and she wanted help explaining this fatal diagnosis to her son. It was a devastating diagnosis. Pancreatic cancer is a terrible way to go. It's a short, brutal, painful end, typically. She then went to a healing center and began writing and calling me, saying that she was seeing some amazing recoveries around her. She herself was getting better. She hoped I would look into it, especially since I had this dual background in medicine and theology. And I said no. I didn't.
All great stories start with a no.
Right. Yeah. I didn't think anything likely was going on. But Nikki, I owe a lot of credit to her. She was persistent. She began having people call me from around the country and elsewhere, saying that they had medical data for their recoveries. Did I want to hear the stories? I continued to say no for a while, but people began sending me their files. And most of the files that I read could be explained from within the context of my training as a physician. Whether you say that they're just a really good responder to chemotherapy or whatever it was. But some of the stories I couldn't explain, and they made no sense within the standpoint of my training, even as a theologian, frankly, some of them. long and short of it is, in 2003, I did begin investigating this. And I was very confused at the time. And so I set up three very rigorous criteria for approaching these this data. I said, number one, the person had to have a genuinely incurable illness, according to all that we currently understand. Mm-hmm. And number two, they had to have medically indisputable evidence for accurate diagnosis and clear evidence for recovery. And then number three, there needed to be no experimental or no good other explanation for how they got better, whether that's an experimental medication or something else. Yep. So that slowly began to create a path through stories that initially to me were very confusing. The truth is, many of the people who originally approached me, some of them thought they were getting better, but the evidence didn't support that. Some people, and these are stories that are very emotional. They're loaded with a lot of longing and desire, and every disease has its own unique pathway. Every cancer is unique in its presentation, in its trajectory, in its likelihood of recovery. Some cancers are fatal, some are not. Some you die with them, but not from them. Some respond to chemotherapy, some don't. So it takes a lot of medical knowledge and consultation sometimes with highly trained specialists to sort out the trajectory of every case that I ended up investigating. And so it's a labor-intensive piece of work. And it took a lot of careful work to begin separating out the true stories of recovery from ones that had other potential explanations, or you can't tell what happened.
Right. Was it, I'll just use the word scary. You know, you're a classically trained clinician, and you know how it seems like me as an outsider looking in that you guys kind of eat your young at times. You know what I mean? Like, you know, pioneers get arrows in their back. Was there a little bit of that holding you back early on? Just like, what are my peers going to do to me?
Yeah, I think that's a good question and a complicated answer, in the sense that I think, looking back, the world has changed a lot in the last 20 years. You can now talk about things as an academic physician and not lose your career.
Yep.
10 years ago, it was a different story, especially 15 years ago, it was a different story. Yep. It's absolutely true that I was very concerned about all of this, and I purposefully took a long time with the research and the publication of CURE because I didn't think the culture was ready for it.
Right.
A lot is changing. The mission statement at Harvard Medical School has changed now to include the study of well-being, which is something that was historically not part of the mission statement at Harvard Medical School. And so you don't lose your career anymore for talking about things like spirituality. You sometimes have to be careful about it, but it's not near like it used to be. So lots of change.
2002, and you published your book in 2020.
That's correct.
Right. Makes sense.
Right.
So, I want to read a quote, Dr. Rediger, that I really loved. I mean, it was your writing that I'm making into a quote. Okay.
Yeah.
It says, people who decide they aren't going to wait for experts to come up with the solutions they need. You're talking, I left one sentence out of that. It's more like you're making a statement here. Those who feel the pull of something higher are the drivers of progress. Your choices have the power to shape not only your own health and vitality, but also the field of medicine. Wow. Can you share more on that?
Yeah, that's a big topic. I gave this keynote address a few years ago at the University of Texas, Austin, and it was a do-it-yourself conference. And these people are just amazing because they're not waiting for the experts or the docs to find a solution for their illnesses. And so you meet these amazing people, and this is a growing movement, and it just shows what's shifting in our culture as people begin to take responsibility for their health and their bodies. They become the CEOs of their own health and well-being. And it's the democratization of medicine really is what it is. And I think medicine has been resistant to the democratizing forces that are slowly spreading around the world, but it's starting to happen for really big reasons. But the do-it-yourself movement is part of that. And so I met a person, for example, who had been diagnosed with very brittle type 1 diabetes around age, I think she was 14 when it was diagnosed, and a very severe case. So she would go to sleep at night, but not know for sure that she was going to wake up because her blood sugar would fluctuate so much. And if it goes too low, you die. And it just was too dangerous. Just a little bit of insulin would shoot it way too high. And I mean, so there's this difficult to control, and she couldn't exercise. She couldn't live a normal life. And what she decided to do was to create an artificial pancreas. She was a computer scientist. So she created this artificial pancreas software, made it open source so that others could adapt it to their own situation, and just did this amazing thing. And I was just so inspired by her story that she would do that and then make it open source like that. So other people now around the world are adapting their own to their own situation. So now she can sleep safely. She exercises, she lives a fairly normal life, and her blood sugars are much more regulated. And so that's a growing movement around the world, is this do-it-yourself movement. I met a person who designed the surgery that saved their life. they that's read incredible. His mother had died from the same illness that he had. He was on disability, but he found something like a report from 1920 approximately, where this kind of surgery that involved scraping out this one part of the adrenal gland out of this mouse solved the problem. And so he's now a motivational speaker.
He convinced
the scientist to keep progressively doing the same surgery on larger animals until he finally convinced a doc to do the surgery on him. And it cured him. And so the amount of just moxie and investigation and taking responsibility for one's future and health, these stories are inspiring. And so I am very interested not only in those who found pathways with nutrition and healing their identity, which I write about in Cure, but I'm also very much interested in the do-it-yourselfers who helped invent the new technologies. It's part of the same democratizing impulse that's spreading around the world.
Is your work at Cure trying to give them an on-ramp to that has some rigor to it? Would that be part of what you're trying to do, is to help give them a place to go and have some safety and medical rigor?
These people often don't know where to go with their stories. Doctors don't know what to do with them. And, you know, I've been interviewing people for 2 decades now, basically. Not a single person that I've spoken to has ever had a doctor become interested in how they got better. And and people long to have validation from a doctor around their stories to help them understand it better and to just validate it. And that typically doesn't happen. The good doctors say, well, whatever you're doing, keep doing it.
But, you know, that's funny. With our patients at Tiger Medical, we see that. You know, we have a customer who had a A1C of 14.7. He was diagnosed with type 1 juvenile diabetes at 60 years old.
Really,
an outlier case. And our doctor said, I'm going to look at this as if it's an autoimmune disorder instead. And he went down that route and was able to basically cure that. He's got a 5.5 today.
That's wild.
But again, his doc didn't really care. She cared. I'm not saying she didn't care. Whatever you're doing, keep doing it. That was it. She didn't ask, what did you do? How did you do it? And I have the unique perspective, though. Like, the one thing we don't do at Tiger, we do not bash doctors, because they work their tail off to become an MD or DO.
Yes.
And they are busy. The current model of medicine forces them into this hamster wheel.
Yes.
And they're just really busy, burdened people. So they're just the training they get, that's how they do medicine. So I don't tear them down. And I think they're just too busy to really build to chase down that trail, because even if they did figure it out, they wouldn't be able to profitably practice medicine in a way that this person solved it, probably.
Yes, there's a lot of factors, I think, that keep docs in the path that they do. I mean, medicine is brilliant in so many ways.
Yeah.
And I use this model, this way of thinking of it, that Western medicine is like a long series of ambulances at the bottom of a cliff. And when people fall off the cliff, Western medicine is brilliant at whisking people to the clinic or the hospital and fixing you up.
Yep.
And once keeping you alive and helping you tread water. But why don't we put a guardrail at the top of the cliff so people don't fall off in the first place? The people I study did fall off the cliff, but they figured out how to construct ladders that took them back to the top.
Yep.
And there's ways to do that, which we don't study. Now, what's fascinating to me is that the people I study, I mean, they're the ultimate achievers of health and well-being. These are the super athletes.
Yep.
You know, and my contention is we study ultimate performance in sports. We study ultimate performance in business. Why don't we study ultimate performance in health and well-being? Because these are the flagships for a new way of doing health and well-being. But these individuals, through massive amount of effort, and they're like the Tom Brady's of they really are. And it's most of us are not going to do what they do. These are the people that get screened out in the scientific studies because they're doing things really differently than the average person. Every scientific study reduces things around the mean, around what's average. And absolutely, if I was ill, I would want to know what the average person does. But I also would want to know what the ultimate performers in health are doing, because just like Tom Brady is doing things really differently than the average athlete, these people who find a path back to health and do climb up those ladders back to the top of the cliff, they're doing things really differently. Now, not all of us are going to be Tom Brady when it comes to health and well-being. Right. But if all of us did a fraction of what they're doing, we would see a massive reduction in the major killers in this country: heart disease, diabetes, lung disease, cancer, autoimmune illness. These are lifestyle illnesses almost completely. 85% of the illnesses from which people suffer are lifestyle illnesses, but we treat them as if they're incurable and we just put a person on a medication, send them on their way, and that doesn't heal anything.
No, it just masks. And you know, you kind of laid out a really good way of looking at this. You know, you studied the people that climb back up to the peak.
Right.
What we're doing at Tiger Medical is we're working with people who haven't got to the peak yet, but they see it and they want to change it before they fall over the edge.
Yes. That's awesome. Yeah. That's really critical service.
Yeah. And I want to go into the four drivers now of spontaneous healing that you outline in your book, because when I looked at them, three of the first three we do with our patients.
Wow.
Fourth one, we're trying to figure out how to do that now better.
Yeah.
But so I want to go into that now, because this is really the core of your book, the message. And I want to hear, because if people hear this from you, what I want to encourage them to do is go buy the book and really read it so you understand it.
Yeah.
And then go put these four things into your life and it'll change your life. So that's what this next, we have about 20 minutes to do that. Okay.
It's awesome.
Let's start with eating, Dr. Rediger. What kind of changes did you identify in your research that yield the great results in terms of changing that inner chemistry in such a way that it's healing?
Well, and I try to show that it's not one size fits all when it comes to nutrition.
Yep.
There's a lot of confusion in our culture, and even doctors and nutritionists have a lot of confusion about what genuine nutrition is. So studying these people that really figured something out to the degree that they had tangible results with their recoveries helped clarify a lot of confusion for me. Mm. The trifecta of industry, which pays the academics to do the studies and get certain results, and how that interacts with lobbyists and all that, is a complicated interaction that has some truth, but also spin science. So it's complicated. So I try to show in Cured that we all come from different ancestries, different parts of the world, different microbiomes that we have. And so different things work better for different people, and one needs to become really clear about experimenting and figuring out what you need to eliminate and what you need to add, and that sort of thing. And I show that there's a number of different diets, but this is not about a fad diet. This is about giving right. your body the nutrition it needs. It's not about certain proportions on the plate. It's not about counting calories.
Right.
It's about finding the way to give your body the most nutrient dense foods so that it has what it needs to recover and has what it needs to reverse the chronic inflammation that's creating the illness in the first place.
That makes sense.
So, and some people that I studied did continue eating meat and animal products. 88% of the people I studied did become vegetarians, but again, not everybody did.
Yep.
Most of the, and I will say that the people that did continue eating meat, they improved the quality of the animal products they were consuming so that they, sure. by and large, made sure that those animal products were grass-fed yep. so that they got the healthier omega-3 fats instead of so many of the unhealthy omega-6 fats. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. They began to consume animal products that didn't have the steroids or antibiotics that had been given to those animals for weight gain. They began to eliminate the animal products that had a lot of chemicals in them, or even animals that had been raised in really stressful conditions.
Mm.
If you're eating chickens that have been in such tiny pens that their beaks were cut off so they wouldn't peck themselves to death because the stress was so high in those crowded conditions, those stress hormones that they live in, to then put that into your body, that's not going to be good for you. It's going to not have a good effect on your own physiology. And so there's a lot of things around what it means to either eliminate animal products or to make sure that the animal products that you consume are of high enough quality that you're mm-hmm. not bringing a lot of the detrimental effects of those into your own body.
So this would be things like free range, cage free, you know, antibiotic free, grass fed.
That's right. Grass fed is big. Antibiotic free, chemical free is really big.
Yep.
Stress free is really big. Mm-hmm. I think it's also important to understand, for example, I had quite a series of transformations myself. I lost 40 pounds on the way through this whole pattern of beginning to recognize and understand what people were teaching me about nutrition. Yep. And I what I thought was hunger for a number of years was actually addiction to sugar, for example. Yes. I had no idea.
Yeah, your glycemic index was spiking all the time, right?
Yeah, I'm sure it was. Yeah. And the average person over 100 years ago consumed 4 pounds of sugar a year, no big deal. The average person now in the United States consumes 154 pounds of sugar a year. And your body just isn't made to handle that kind of load. And so what happens is these sharp sugar granules go coursing through your bloodstream. Yep. They bounce off of your arteries and create these little cuts that your brilliant immune system cells come in with all their specialized armies to repair those cuts. But if you're taking such a high load of sugar into your life, into your body, then you're creating cut after cut after cut. And so the immune system has a massive amount of energy diverted to repairing your arteries and your body constantly. And then you get scar on top of scar on top of scar, and that's called atherosclerosis.
Yeah.
So it's this sugar is a big deal when you take it at the level that we do. I mean, I went to Whole Foods recently. I bought salmon patties. Or I was going to until I realized those have sugar in them. I read a Supreme Court case in Ireland recently. Subway, the fast food Subway stores, they no longer are allowed to have their bread taxed as bread in Ireland any longer because the sugar content is so high. Wow. So that's wild because refined flour is basically sugar. Yeah. And so we have to become more aware of how much sugar is in the meats we buy, in the tomato sauces we buy, and the cereals we buy, and begin becoming more aware of what it means to eliminate that. And again, for me, I realized rather painfully, I was addicted to sugar. It wasn't that I thought that was hunger, but it wasn't. It was sugar withdrawal.
Well, you know, something simple people can do is eliminate foods in bags and boxes.
Yes.
Right. All the processed foods and try to cut down on sugar and eat real food, stuff that is like real, like in produce and the cleaned up meats. And, you know, I also own a health food store. I own an organic market with supplements and an organic cafe here in Florida where I live.
Oh, wow.
In addition to the medical institute. And we, you know, our clients will talk about, you know, man, it's so expensive to shop like this. And we say it's more expensive to get sick.
It really is. Yeah. I can tell you that the amount of health and well-being that I personally have experienced by making that change is huge. Now, I will also say there's ways to do this that are not expensive, whether it's brown rice and beans or peanut butter and sprouted bread, for example. Mm-hmm. The people I study, by and large, markedly reduced sugar, markedly reduced the refined flours.
Yep.
Markedly reduced even the breads that say they're whole wheat, but actually are enriched flour and eliminated most of the processed foods. And those steps, completely apart from the issue around animal products, had the biggest effect on their health and well-being. Just massive effect in terms of reducing inflammation in their bodies.
Well, I get to the next one. How does someone improve their immune function, Dr. Rediger? Because that's also one of the four drivers here.
It sure is. Yeah, the people I studied healed their immune systems.
And that's what attacked the pathology, right? Rather than the doctors doing it.
Yeah, and I think what's prevented docs from seeing the issue and the importance of this is we're all trained in body parts. And, you know, if you're interested in the heart, you become a cardiologist. If you're interested in the brain, you become a neurologist or a psychiatrist, et cetera. But the truth is, a person doesn't have a heart problem or a diabetes problem or a cancer problem or an autoimmune disease per se. What we suffer from typically is a chronic inflammation, and that's a problem of the immune system. And so, and so instead of diverting all of that brilliant energy in your body to healing the immune system chronically from the stuff you're putting in it, we need to help people begin reversing the chronic inflammation in your body. And then that's what begins to reverse these illnesses, which are autoimmune. Cancer tends to be autoimmune disease. Diabetes is an autoimmune disorder. Heart disease, autoimmune disorder. High blood pressure, autoimmune disorder. These are failures of the immune system. And so it's not just, it's not bacterial or viral infections only that involve the immune system. It's all of these illnesses that are a breakdown of the immune system and that create these illnesses. It's really the body attacking itself. That's what autoimmune is. And so diabetes is the body attacking itself, and reversing the chronic inflammation is what gives people pathways to healing.
So real quick clarifying question. So when someone's eating sugar and all of those spiked crystals are coursing through your veins and cutting you on the inside, that's eliciting an inflammatory response, right?
That's right.
That's how we heal those cuts.
That's right. That's right. Because, and so the immune system is brilliant. And so it goes to those cuts and heals them by putting a scab, basically stitching a scab up over that cut. And over and over, scab on top of scab, that's what creates chronic inflammation and creates a disease process. And that's what needs to be reversed. The medication is not going to reverse that.
No. Well, that's you know, in my family, your quote, you know, I got proactive about my health, and I come from a family. My dad's had 9 heart attacks, and he's still alive. He's 80 years old. So he's benefited from stents and all of that stuff. Right. And it's interesting. I finally got him to start doing the things that we do at our medical institute. And now he says he feels better than he's felt in years, even though it's so late in the game for him. You know, we've brought his A1C down. We've got him having more energy and all of that. But what's really been fun to watch is that my son and daughter have adopted the lifestyle as well, as have their spouses. And so my wife and I come from not so great genetics, even though genetics aren't the whole story. We know that.
Right.
But we've changed the whole trajectory of our family and our grandkids because of that choice to become proactive. And that's what's possible, isn't it?
That's what's possible. And we now know, I mean, when I was in med school, we were taught that basically everything's genetic and that mapping the genome was going to be the solution. Well, now we know that genes are turned on and off by lifestyle choices, by nutrition, by our sleep and quality and by how we feel about ourselves and the universe at a deep level. We know now that that's a huge, huge deal. So what you're doing with the generations of your family and with your institute, that's massive for so many people.
Yeah. Well, it's you and me are both men on mission with this. So
we're
kindred spirits here. So let's talk about the stress response, which is really talking about autonomic nervous system balance, right?
Yes, that's right.
Why don't you jump into that? Because that's a big thing we work with our clients on, is convincing them that it's important to do on a daily basis.
Yes. And I'm not necessarily interested in reducing stress as much as changing one's relationship with it.
Correct.
There are some stresses we need to get rid of, for sure.
Yep.
But, you know, running a marathon can be great.
It's adaptive. Right.
Right. Exactly. But if it helps you reach into your higher self and expand your understanding of what you're capable of, that is massive in terms of health and well-being. So that's one thing, but it's a very different thing if a person finishes work every day, depleted, run down, or is in a relationship where you are told or feel that you don't matter.
Right.
And that's a daily experience. Then that gets into the domain of what's more related to toxic stress. And in that kind of situation, a person needs to either change their environment or change their response to their environment. And that takes a lot of work.
It does. We do something called heart rate variability training, which is essentially doing breath work, learning how to get into heart coherence.
Right.
Because when you're in that coherent state, that's the healing state. And all we're telling our clients is we're not trying to take stress away. We're just teaching you how to self-regulate through it.
Yep.
Because it turns all those harmful, that beautiful response becomes maladaptive when it's toxic.
Yeah, that's a beautiful thing. And that's the future of what I think a lot of health is exactly what you're doing. To help people get out of chronic fight, flight, or freeze into a more parasympathetic and healing state where you are bathing the beautiful cells of your immune system with dopamine, the pleasure pathway, or with serotonin, the antidepressant molecule, with oxytocin, the love molecule. Your body, our bodies, our immune systems love those molecules, and they wake up and begin performing correctly and accurately.
Yeah.
And that's how they begin to straighten themselves out so that the autoimmune disorder, the self-attacking immune system, no longer has to malfunction.
Well, the way you treated that in your book was the best I've seen. And so I'm using that now with our patients to help them understand just how vital it is. Even if you can 5 minutes in the morning, 5 minutes at lunchtime, and like 10 minutes at bed, we teach them to get into that state breathing.
Yeah.
And because, you know, I learned a lot from Bruce McEwen. Have you heard of him?
He died
a couple of years ago. Brilliant endocrinologist.
Yep.
And he talked to how stress is cumulative. And,
yes.
And so I used those arguments. And then that whole idea of you can upregulate your immune function, you can improve your mental health, you can improve your recovery and your sleep just by doing this breath work every day. So
huge.
Yes. All right. And the last piece now, just talks about healing our identities. And now you're getting maybe into the spiritual dimension as well.
Yeah, right.
I'll have you bring us home on this section, Dr. Rediger, because this is the fourth of four things that if you will build these things into your life, these are what you found to be instrumental in spontaneous healing. But our message today is not only that, but if you're already healthy, employ these now to prevent you from going over the cliff.
Yeah. And my publisher said that he really believes in cured because of this pillar. He said that 40 books will be written on nutrition this year. And this was in 2020 when the book was published, just at the beginning of the pandemic. But he said, to his knowledge, nobody's ever said that if you want to heal at the deepest level, you need to heal your identity. And this is a big one. So what does it mean to heal your identity? I think the truth is we all grow up, we inherit a set of true and false beliefs from our parents, mm-hmm. true and false beliefs from kids on the playground, from teachers, from colleagues, from loved ones, from mentors, from our interpretations of traumas that occur, physical, emotional, sexual abuse, other kinds of things that wear us down right. internally. And some of these are true, some are false, some are conscious, some are unconscious. And I think the truth is, if you have a complex set of true and false beliefs, you're going to have mixed results in your mind, in your body, in your life. And so what does it mean to heal these beliefs that one's not good enough, or that there's something missing, or something defective about who we are? The people I studied sometimes made so much progress with healing their beliefs that some of them didn't make changes with nutrition or with these mm-hmm. other pillars, but this is a big one. And so mm-hmm. what does it mean to truly heal your beliefs in a way that you experience the unrepeatable dignity and value of who you are as a human being, the magnificence of what you bring into the world in a way that you can rely on that and not question that and rest in that? That's massive in terms of this. It's shocking how deep this goes. I can't
tell you. Well, you're a psychiatrist. You deal with it every day, don't you?
I do. And I think it's such a big deal for all of us, frankly. You know, I think I could just tell you story after story. One story comes to mind, a woman that had breast cancer, for example. And in the context of her healing, she had always been this very sweet lady. I think her husband loved her, but he was pretty rough with her verbally. Mm. And in the context of her healing from breast cancer, she became less compliant, less of a quote unquote nice person. And she began to just say what was real. And she became more saucy, more racy, more, I'm going to tell you what I really think sort of thing. Right. And I've seen that pattern so many times, that when a person begins to respect who they are and take up space in the world because they respect the light that they have within them, it really does require a lot of changes. I think many people initially feel selfish when they begin this kind of pathway and they begin to respect who they are, because they've spent so much of their lives taking care of others, so much time responding to the perceived expectations of others, mm-hmm. and not spent enough time paying attention to what they really need. My friend Gabor Mate says, if you don't know how to say no, your body will eventually say no for you. Mm-hmm. And that is such a profound statement. Our medical hospitals and our psychiatric hospitals are full of people who have not known where to say no, yep. and where to say yes to the dignity and value of what they bring in the world. And that is a beautiful, brilliant statement that Gabor makes.
Dr. Redeker, where do people get help with this, in your opinion? Because obviously you're very busy. You can't have everybody calling you off in this podcast or whatever. Where do you get help for something like this?
Well, I think, so we've talked briefly about the four pillars of healing and well-being. I think what's exciting is that we are in a world that is slowly democratizing itself so that people can become the CEOs of their own health and well-being. There's a lot of books and people out there. Your institute is a shining example of the kind of things that are the future of health and well-being and medicine. And I think the internet has progressively better information. There's things you can't trust, but there's books. I can recommend books that are reliable around some of these pillars and well-being. And so we are at the end of the age of disease and medications, and the new era that is beginning to open is the era of health and well-being, where people are back in charge of their health and well-being. And no longer is a doctor who sees you for 15 minutes at a time the sole expert on what creates health for you.
Well, Dr. Redeker, I think at a minimum, people should get your book Cured, C-U-R-E-D. I've read it. It's the best book I've read on this topic, or on just on proactive health in many mm-hmm. years. So I fully endorse it. And you can get that everywhere, right? Barnes & Noble, mm-hmm. you can get
That's
it
right.
at Amazon.
It's everywhere.
Do you have a website you want people to know about?
Yeah, sure. Dr. Jeffrey Redeker.com is available.
Okay, yep. Yeah. And our show note producer will get that accurate in there so people can see it.
That's awesome.
And, Dr. Redeker, it is an honor to have you on today. Thank you for appearing in the Tiger Performance Podcast.
It's really been a pleasure to be here. I really love what your institute's doing. I think it is the future of medicine and well-being. And it's so exciting to see the kind of things that you're doing gain more of a voice in this world.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Tiger Performance Podcast. We'll see you again next time, and be sure to click subscribe to get the future episodes.